The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Hi, I'm Cheryl, and I'm a filmmaker. I'm not really a filmmaker, but I have a videotaping business with my friend Tamara, and I work at a video store, so I'm working on being a filmmaker. The problem is I don't know what I want to make a film on.
Hey everyone, another Loose Cannons podcast coming at ya. We're continuing our guest host month. This week, and joining us is Claire, PhD at Oregon in film. She's been on the podcast once before, but sadly, only the people who participated in that podcast got to hear it. It's been lost in the Loose Cannons annals, but we're really glad to have her back. Say hello, Claire.
Hello. Thank you for the introduction. Sorry about the lost one. live on in myth.
It's true.
Legend.
Is there anything else you would like to say about yourself?
I'm not sure I say why I picked the film.
We can do that when we go into the discussion.
Anything to plug?
So I have some news. As I always say, loosecannons.net. You can check out all of our work there, writings, podcasts, and videos. Plural. By the time this podcast is released, the first video that's a video analysis as opposed to just a montage will be up. Exciting news. So get on that. By now you will either know or you're about to know. It's about Kristen Stewart, and I hope that you enjoy it. Today we're going to be talking about The Watermelon Woman, though, 1996 The Watermelon Woman, directed by Cheryl Dunye. But before we do that, let's do this, heralds and denouncements. Patrick, got any?
Yes, I would like to... Whoa. Oh, that's right, I'm sorry. I almost forgot. my denouncement this week is going to be of Kingsman: The Secret Service, Matthew Vaughn's film from this year. It's a terrible film. Matthew Vaughn apparently also thinks that murdering people in very strange ways is hilarious. Even good characters. I know that there are a lot of bad characters that he murders in funny ways, but even good characters, I feel like when they get killed in this movie, you're supposed to be like, whoa, amazing. And I was just watching it. I was just like, how does anybody find this entertaining? Like, how does anybody enjoy, like, at any moment, a character that you're supposed to be rooting for could just be murdered horribly? And I was just like, I don't understand how that's fun. And I also, like, it's just a movie that seems really... horribly sexist in certain ways. There's a whole, like, kind of a plot point at the end of the movie where the main character finds this princess who's been trapped by the bad guys, and she's like, I'll give you sex if you get me out of here. And so he, like, you know, it's supposed to be funny, like, he runs off to save the world just so he can have sex with this girl. And I was just like, good lord, what is going on here?
I think there's a way that scene could have worked, because it's, like, so obvious and over the top that it feels like maybe the most satirical moment in the actual film. That's like, oh, this is just like a Bond film. He saves the world, and then he has sex with a woman, except we're going to make it even more explicit and gross. Except for the whole rest of the movie has you liking that character.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't make a satire of a Bond film, but then still be like, Bond's cool, though.
Right. It's I also just didn't think any of the performances in it were very good. It just was not, it was not a good movie at all. So, the end.
Claire?
It's me next.
Oh yeah, it's Basil next. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
It's all right. The only things I can herald are movies that I watched that were on our last canon, and I just rewatched them. I rewatched His Girl Friday and Ratatouille, and they're both still good. So instead, I am going to denounce Jurassic World. I'm sure it'll probably come up again in our end of the year podcast because it's one of the worst movies that I've seen all year. I didn't like it at all. And in a similar way to what Patrick was saying, I feel like the movie wants to be a satire at some points of, I don't know, consumerism and capitalism and how our culture is just really disaffected by everything. And even if we had dinosaurs, eventually we'd just get like bored of them and be like, give us new dinosaurs. And like looking at our phones instead or whatever. But then it wants us to like all the characters, like all the main hero characters. And I'm like, you can't really have a satire and then have like a bunch of characters that are just like standard action movie characters that we're supposed to be like, yeah, these guys are cool. I don't know. Like, to me, the biggest one is that, like, Chris Pratt's character is, like, a gamesman guy, but he's supposed to be, like, nicer than the Robert Muldoon guy from Jurassic Park. So instead of, like, this Australian guy who's, like, all about hunting, he's, like, an animal trainer. And the very first scene with him is him, like, training velociraptors to, like, do tricks. And that just makes me think of, like, SeaWorld and dolphins. And I'm like, okay, that's like gross, but the movie doesn't seem to like think that it's really gross, or if it does, like, it doesn't matter that the hero of the movie is also a guy who like trains animals to do tricks so that people can enjoy it. I don't know, it's a big old confused mess of a movie, and I was not into it.
Yeah.
Now Claire.
Now me.
If you have any heralds or denouncements.
Yeah, I meant to watch like all women directors this summer, but I've fallen into this noir kick. And so I just watched Otto Preminger's Laura from 1944 for the first time with Jean Tierney and Dana Andrews, and it was really good.
I like that movie a lot.
Yeah.
I like that movie.
Yeah,
too.
Really good. Great soundtrack and an interesting, you know, like definitely noir, but like I think interesting twists with the characters and the femme fatale.
My favorite part of that movie is when the detective goes to our home and just gets drunk and passes out in like the middle of the day. at the potential victim's home.
Yeah, like while staring at her pictures, it's really creepy and going through her stuff.
Well, I'll kind of keep riding that denouncement train. I guess the movie that I felt most strongly about since we last did a podcast is a movie called Into the Wild, which is pretty much captures almost everything that I hate about modern movie filmmaking. It's a movie that is supposed to be about a young white man like searching for real freedom, but really what he's doing is sort of like burning up his privilege in a way that is like totally unnecessary and not helpful to anyone else. It's just like he makes his life worse while making nobody else's life better, and like it seems really celebratory of that for reasons that are like beyond me. Like, I'm pretty much not a huge fan of like red tape and bureaucracy and stuff like that, but there's a part where he wants to like kayak down a river, and the guy's like, you have to get a permit, and he's like, a permit to kayak down the river? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, there's like a 2-year waiting list or something like that. And I was like, this is kind of ridiculous. But then he's like running away from the police as he's kayaking down the river in like the next scene, and I'm like, this is way more ridiculous than the bureaucracy. Like, just go to a different river, dude. Like,
yeah,
you can get a permit to kayak in rivers in Birmingham like today. He also literally sets money on fire at one point, and we're supposed to like him because he doesn't have sex with a 16-year-old girl, even though he does nothing that's admirable besides that. There's only one. That's the only scene and it's so obviously like plugged in to make us like him because he's a good guy, because he won't have sex with a 16-year-old. That's like, I hate this movie.
It's just bizarre.
That's for some reason Sean Penn just does not strike me as like the type of person who I would like. Like, at all.
No.
Considering all
he's
of this.
He's the worst type of gonzo liberal who, like, thinks that he's being liberal, but he's actually deeply, deeply conservative.
Yeah. Yeah, as evidenced by his his racist comment at the Academy Awards this year, right before he presented the Best Picture award to Birdman.
What did he say? I can't remember.
He was just like, he was like, who the hell gave that guy his green card? And he was like, Birdman won. I was like, oh my god. Because apparently he's friends with Inyara too, so it was like a joke they had going. But it was like, it's context is stripped away in that, like, you have to be aware that, like...
a joke between friends is supposed to be kept
friends. You can't just say that joke to everybody in the world because it doesn't have the same context between you
not
and everybody.
Not everyone remembers 21 grams.
Anyways, that movie was really, really bad, in my opinion. I only watched it because of the Kristen Stewart video that I mentioned earlier, and it was the worst one of all the Kristen Stewart movies I watched. And there were some bad ones. Anyways, today's movie, Watermelon Woman. Claire, can you give us a little bit of a plot description, and then we'll go into the reviews?
Yeah, definitely. So, 1996, it's, the interesting thing is kind of blurred between reality and fiction, but it's about a black lesbian filmmaker who is researching an actress from the 30s who is primarily in, like, these kind of mammy roles in Hollywood. And so she starts researching her, and it also helps her work through some things in her own life. Does that sound right?
Good by me.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
Sounds like what's going on.
I guess
on.
I'm next. I like this movie. I wish I liked this movie more because its ideas are so strong and interesting, but I had so many problems with the way that it was constructed that it was hard for me to get into it as much as I would have liked to. Basically, if it were an essay, I guess it would be like one of my favorite essays, but as a movie I felt like it was held back by certain aesthetic limitations that didn't work for me. Specifically the weird thing where like a scene would start going and then it would just fade out in the middle of it, that I felt like I didn't really understand why she was doing that.
I have a theory, but I'll get into that later.
I also like this movie, although I did feel like its, I guess, financial restrictions showed at some points, some of the ways it was shot and stuff, and some of the performances are a little, they just feel kind of like line readings sometimes. It's just like they're, like, memorizing words as opposed to actually, like, being in a scene with another person. But other than that, like, I did think it had a very strong thematic core, and I thought it expressed those ideas in a way that wasn't really didactic. It was more, like, natural and kind of free-flowing, and it didn't like, hit thematic points with a hammer all the time. It was like, you know, here's our point, but we're going to kind of, like, inject it into some sort of reality. So I liked that it did that.
Yeah, I like this movie a lot. I watched it, I guess it's been probably about a month now, because by odd coincidence, we watched it in the feminist film theory class that I was taking then. So I didn't have a chance to revisit it, so my points might be more broad than everyone else who's seen it recently, although I do have a lot to say about the movie. I like it a lot. And most of the construction issues don't bother me, and I will get into why as we talk.
Claire?
Yeah, I liked it too. I thought the acting was charmingly bad. Yeah, I was really drawn to it because I love film history, and I like the idea of recovering a history that, that hasn't been, that's not there for the mainstream. Yeah, and the construction didn't bother me as much. I could kind of see it working for probably, we'll get into that, but yeah, I liked it.
Basil?
Okay, I guess I'll just go ahead and jump right into it. One of the things that we sort of talked a lot about in my class was obviously Laura Mulvey's essay on narrative films and visual pleasure is like a pretty, I don't know, groundbreaking feminist essay that kind of, I think, sort of pioneered the idea of the male gaze. I think she was the very first person to really talk about that, and now it's like a pretty big deal. So it's obviously one of the most influential essays in film history. And one of the things that she talks about in it is that for like women filmmakers, they need to kind of create an almost anti-cinema, that somehow the way that patriarchy exists within film culture has become so ingrained within Hollywood narrative cinema that the only way to really break it is by making non-narrative movies. Like, if you make a narrative movie, you're already sort of embodying patriarchy, whether or not you want to. So in some ways, I thought that the sort of construction of this movie, while not completely non-narrative, it does eschew a lot of Hollywood standard ideas of like how to use a transition and how to construct a scene. And I thought that maybe Dunier used them on purpose to sort of create like a Brechtian like distanciation, where it's sort of reminding you that you're watching this fake movie, that it's like a fake movie, and then at the end of the movie you find out that it's a fake history, that she made it up because the woman doesn't exist. And I think that that's a really cool thing if it's on purpose. And I can't think of any way or reason why it wouldn't be on purpose, because even though you have a low budget, like almost every scene transition is either a fade or a wipe, and I feel like no one ever uses those in the 90s. So like the fact that she's using them so consistently and so so like overtly makes me feel like it was sort of a more than just like budgetary limitation, but like an actual thing that she was doing. And I feel like a lot of women artists that are doing digital stuff now are doing similar things, where they're like embracing old web aesthetics like 1990s and early 2000s Angel Fire and like GeoCities web aesthetics, and that's a similar sort of way of like breaking this the internet as another kind of like largely patriarchal structure that's sort of unwelcoming to women.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
About that last point, though, one of the biggest people of like old internet art, though, is actually my cousin, and is a man, and is kind of sexist.
He got in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, he's gotten in a lot of trouble, but he like invented Dump FM, which was like a huge like kind of started like the whole GIF movement, with like old GIFs, and he was like, he used to like archive Alta Vista pages and stuff like that, and was like very much like an old net art person for like a very long time. And yeah, the feminist art community does not like him very much.
They sure don't. But I remember the first time, because I'd heard of him through you, I remember the first time someone else on my Facebook page like posted a story about him, and I was like, oh, I guess he's way more famous than I even realized.
Yep. Anyway, I mean, I don't know. I think your stuff makes sense, but I wish she had done it in funnier or smarter ways than the way that it's done here. I guess the thing that I always think about, I guess, in terms of like Brechtian stuff, is the scene in Weekend when the two like blue collar guys are like describing the socialist revolution and like how it's going to take place and like how the bourgeois take advantage of the poor and like how boring the scene is, and then it cuts to a scene of the very rich people being bored by it, basically saying that if you're bored by this scene, that you're just as awful as these people who murder a character on screen like a scene or two before. And it always makes me laugh and feel sad. I don't know. I mean, I think your point is well made, but I still feel like, I guess, it could have been funnier.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, some of it no doubt has to do with budgetary limitations, like the sound being weird in a lot of scenes and sort of echoey. I'm like, that's not on purpose. That's just the limitations of shooting a movie for $30,000 or whatever this cost.
I did notice some weird panning in the audio. At certain times when people would talk, it sounded like their voice was kind of warbling between like both headphones, because I was wearing headphones while I was watching it, so I could tell that there was some audio weirdness, and I just assumed that was because it was a low budget movie and they probably mixed it, you know, in a way that didn't pick that up. So I mean, all that stuff is definitely in there, but no, I'm never like too harsh on low budget movies, because I've made low budget movies myself, so I understand like all the limitations and how hard it is to get stuff together like that. But I think what this movie like really has going for it is that it does feel really playful a lot of the time, and Cheryl herself is just really like, she has a good charisma and a good energy to her, and like she's always, I particularly like the scene where she's like lip syncing the dialogue from Plantation Memories, where she's like lip syncing the Watermelon Woman's dialogue and like wearing this headscarf and just like, you know, like play acting. And I was just like, that's a funny scene. Like, it just really shows off the personality of her as, I don't know, I guess a person and a character in the movie too. I also thought that the sex scene in the movie was really playful in a way that I was relieved by, because I was like, a lot of times I feel like sex scenes are thrown in as like titillation in movies and they tend to take themselves like way too seriously. Like, I feel like I was particularly thinking of the scene in Rage in Harlem. That sex scene is just like, it feels like it's taking itself way too seriously, and it's kind of gross for it.
I don't think that's a good comparison.
And, well, I mean, but that's what I was
especially
thinking
since
of.
Both of those scenes use excessive tongues.
Well, and that's what I was thinking of. That's why I was thinking of it, because I was like, oh, they're using the tongue, but I felt like they were using it in a lot more playful way here, and it felt more, I don't know if right is the word, but more like you felt like these two people belong together, as opposed to that scene in Rage in Harlem where I was like, these two people, there's no reason these two people should be together.
Yeah, I still think I still think that sex scene is really gross in a funny way, so.
Yeah, the scene that I thought of was the scene in Blue is the Warmest Color, and how much worse it is, and how it's so obviously made for the male gaze, the blue is the warmest color. I was like watching it and I was like, this is not for women. It's a scene about two women having sex that so clearly has nothing to do with women in a way that was like that movie, just extremely disappointing and gross. And this scene, I was like, I wouldn't say that I found it unerotic, but I was like, this is just two women doing their thing. It's like, they're obviously into it. It's not for me, in a way in which I really appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. And I imagine that's tricky to do because we're so used to sex scenes for men.
Yeah. And lesbian porn, which is also for men.
Yeah.
Yep. Whenever someone releases one of those studies that says, like, women are less visually stimulated than men, I'm like, Don't you think that's because men control all the visual stimuli? Like, do you think that has something to do with it? That men produce all the visual stimuli? Don't you think women could produce visual stimuli for themselves that they enjoy? Whatever.
And
I'm sure that their eyes are broken, right?
It's true. They're just, it's just a biological distinction, you know. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
Yep.
Oh boy.
Yeah, for the same class that we watched this movie for, we also watched If These Walls Could Talk Too. And that movie has a much weirder sort of, it has two different sex scenes, but they are a lot less ambiguous, and it feels like HBO, even though each of the segments in that is three different segments, and each one is directed by a female filmmaker, which is pretty cool. I feel like the HBO, the producer, like, had a pretty strong hand in how the sex scenes were going to look, because they're very similar to, like, every single hetero sex scene that you've ever seen that's, like, around that time. It's, like, there's a lot of fading, like, during it, and, like, this, like, soft lighting, and, like, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to know how, like, real lesbians have sex or anything. I've never seen that, but the way that they shoot it is, like, very similar to the way that you would shoot a man and a woman having sex. There's, like, one character who's, like, really obviously sort of, like, the more dominant, aggressive one, and they're, like on top of each other in a way that, if, especially during the Sharon Stone, Ellen DeGeneres one, if you just swapped Sharon Stone out for, like, a male actor, the scene wouldn't look any different. Like, it would, and so I'm just like, well, I mean, it's cool that this is, like, I don't know, like, women filmmakers, and this is a thing that you don't see that often in movies, but compared to The Watermelon Woman, which we watched afterwards, I was like, oh, this is how you do it. This is, like, a...
I thought they did a great job with the relationship, too.
Mm-hmm.
They really weren't on screen very long, but you could see why that initial attraction was there, and then why it didn't work very clearly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the smart way. And they also captured the awkwardness of flirting, which few films do, you know?
Yeah, there was nothing smooth about their getting together at first. It basically, this one woman had to just keep putting herself out there until, like, the other one was like, okay, let's fuck.
Yeah. I feel like I could relate to that a bunch, because in retrospect in my life, there were tons of times where I can remember that, like, oh, that woman was totally clearly hitting on me. But, like, in the moment, I was just like, oh, she's just being nice. Like, you know.
Did you like the part when... she said that Sissy Spacek was, like, creepy looking. And to them, I feel like Cheryl was offended by the comments about Sissy Spacek.
Yeah. I think they do a great job with Diana's character in general of making her, like, really obviously, like, privileged without actually Cheryl having to, like, call her out or, like, have some big scene where they're like, oh, you're just, like, a rich white woman. You don't know what it's like or whatever. Like, just the way that she talks about how she isn't really doing anything, and yet she lives in that giant loft. Like, it's, like, an enormous space.
She went to school 7 times or whatever.
Yeah. And,
kept changing her major.
She's like, oh, I'm just, like, volunteering, and I just want to live life. I like to travel. I like to... And then, like, we get the shots of Cheryl's apartment, and it's just, like, tiny studio that's all cramped, and the camera feels like it barely fits in there. I thought that was pretty smart.
And the way that she plays into Diana plays into respectability politics too. It's like, I'm an ally, except for when other people get kind of upset about it, then let's be cool. Like, when they're interviewing that old obviously homophobic woman who's like the sister of the director or whatever, and she's like, let's just be cool, everyone just be cool about this, and it's like, no, yeah, your sister's a lesbian. Like,
and she dated a black woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Annie was kind of a nice continuation because she was a little more ambiguous, but also privileged. Yeah. But not. But she seemed more helpful from what we could tell.
I legitimately got Diana and Annie confused in a few scenes. I was like, oh, wait, no, that's not her girlfriend. That's the girl that works at the video store.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which is funny.
No, I liked Annie.
Yeah, I thought it was funny that I got that I was like, oh, all these white girls look the same.
Oh, they sure do.
All these white girls with the piercings and the, you know, like the
'90s, totally
extreme '90s fashion. I think that was pretty.
I thought Annie was genuinely helpful, though. Diana was a little bit. I don't know. Like, she wanted it on her resume that she was a good ally.
Right.
Whereas Annie was, like, genuinely interested. And I thought it was interesting that Tamara couldn't tell the difference. Like, that she was right to scowl at Diana, but that she was off base about Annie.
Yeah. And that came out really well in the dinner scene at, you know, the double date with Diana and Cheryl and Tamara and her girlfriend, whose name I forget, at their house.
Stacy,
thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you could see both sides, and it was just awkward, uncomfortable dinner. But
yeah.
Yeah. And I love that subplot of Cheryl's relationship with Tamara and what was going on with that. That was really strong. We get so few friendships in films, especially between women.
Yeah, especially like since this is somewhat like a rom-com or whatever, where like the friendship isn't like, I don't know. It's structurally a little similar, but it's still not entirely like, here's the best friend who is like gonna help you get the like main person that you really want to date or whatever.
Right.
Their relationships about a lot of different things.
I thought the scene where they go to see the guy whose name, I forget his name, he's like the archivist who has all the posters and stuff. I can't remember what Tamara...
Lee Edwards.
Yeah, what Tamara says to him is something like that. But he just like gives her the meanest look. He just, like, looks at the camera and he's like...
He's only been paying attention to like films directed by men.
Yeah, yeah, that was
that star black people, not films directed by women. He's like, I don't know how much stuff directed by women I have, and then Tamara's like, of course, something along.
Yeah, actually, lines. Yeah, I wrote that down. Yeah, he says women are not my specialty, and she says, of course they aren't.
Yeah, that's it.
I just thought that scene was funny because of the way that everybody was supposed to be looking at Tamara, but they were just looking into the camera, and so they were making faces at Tamara, but it was just all directly into the camera. I thought that was a funny way to shoot a scene.
And it was, it was something that the movie got well a lot, is that, like, these people could be useful or even good people, but they would still have, like, gaps in their like representation. It's like, oh, here's this guy who cares a lot about black film, but women film, whatever. You know, doesn't right. care about that, you know. And then like Tamara could be like, she was just mean to Annie for like no seemingly good reason. And you know, then Diana, like with the whole privilege thing, it was just like each time it was like there's like they were somewhat good, but then there was also like this like gap in their identity.
And even Cheryl is sort of like I think the movie's like kind of aware that she has a predilection to dating white women, and that the movie's not like just like, hey, everybody be cool, like we all just date each other and it's no big deal. Like, I feel like the movie even sort of takes her to task a little bit for that kind of exotification a little bit. And obviously the other way around, that Diana, there's quite a bit near the end about how much she likes dating black people.
Yeah, I had a black boyfriend, or actually it was two. No, wait, it was three. She's like, yeah, like 24 or something.
I really liked how all the useful information they found was through the community and through connections.
Yeah, that was nice. And I particularly thought the woman who worked at Clit was like, she was funny in a way that wasn't really like insulting. Like, she was. Mm-hmm. She was kind of goofy, but she was goofy in like a realistic way, where it's like you could tell that she was, you know, just who she was as a person, but the way that she interacted with Cheryl and the way that she was different from Cheryl was what was so funny about her, because she was like really a stickler. She's like, you can't be photographing that in here. And then she would like,
right, but then she dumps the box
all over the table. And Cheryl's like freaking out about that. I thought that scene was good.
Yeah, it's probably the only joke about safe spaces that I've ever liked, because it seemed to come from like an honest place that was actually about their flaws, as opposed to a space that, you know, like, most of the time people make jokes about safe spaces, they're just like, it's white men saying like, you know, I should be included, or I should be able to say what I want, I have the freedom to be an asshole or whatever. But like, this woman, when she was like, this is a safe space. And then I think right after that, she like dumps the box of pictures all over the table. It's like, she's a little confused as to what the point of a safe space is, or what its goals are.
Right. But then in contrast to the library, where Cheryl and Tamara go to the library, and they're just so rude.
Oh, yeah.
Patronizing, yeah, and unhelpful.
I also liked the scene with what was her doc, Camille, what's her name, Paglia, is that it?
Mm-hmm. Camille Paglia. Yeah.
Paglia.
Yep.
I thought that whole monologue that she gives about like, I guess the black culture and the way that it shouldn't be seen as shameful or whatever, I thought that was like so right on in terms of like the way that I guess kind of like privileged white liberals talk about that stuff sometimes. That they're like, no, you shouldn't see it as a bad thing, and it's like, no, it's a bad thing. You're just misguided. Like, it's that really like misguided kind of like trying to put a like rosy spin on something that's really ugly.
Yeah, I laughed really hard at all the parts where she kept relating it back to her Italian family.
Yeah.
Right. My favorite part was when she said the watermelon was the same color as the Italian flag. Yeah. That meant anything towards racism?
Yeah. Oh, man.
And actually, my favorite part about that sequence also is that I don't know for sure if... I mean, I think it must be, but that's so close to how Camille Paglia actually is that I was like, is she actually saying this, or is she just, like, playing a really funny, like, really close parody of herself? Because she says a lot of, like, pretty outrageous stuff about, like, women and just, like...
I think she's the one who said that the end of Revenge of the Sith is the best cinematic, or the best film that we've had in like the last 20 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. I was like, okay, I'll give this a chance, and I started watching her thing. It was like a 20-minute discussion, and I watched like 3 minutes of it, and I was like, you haven't made a single point that I care about. Like, one of her points was about the intricacy of the models, and I was like, What?
Yeah.
Weird. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that scene wasn't mediated by Cheryl in any way. It was just they showed it and then cut away.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, the, like, also the implication that she's like, "Oh, don't worry about all this stuff." You know, it's like, it's a positive thing. And then she's like, "Do you know who the watermelon woman is?" And she's like, "No." It's like our, a part of our history has just been thrown in the garbage, but I guess we're not supposed to worry about that. Thanks, Camille Paglia.
Yeah.
There's a quote. I don't remember what it is exactly, and I can't remember who said it, so I can't find it exactly, but it's something like the student asked this famous sociologist. He says, "What is African, or what is black history?" And he says, "It's the missing pages of world history." So, yeah. Definitely relates back to this movie.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is, like, the most interesting that the movie gets at is just that the, like, people's existence as, like, who they are just gets erased because of, the way that like history is constructed and things that are taboo, and so then you can't talk about them, and then like 100 years later maybe no one even knows that like, for instance, that a character is a lesbian or had this relationship that they had. One of the other essays that we read in the class was about, mentioned briefly, there's an American writer, woman, who wrote, like, My Antonia and a bunch of...
Oh, Willa Cather.
Yeah, Willa Cather, yeah. And the essay's about how Willa Cather's, like, super famous as a writer, and no one talks about the fact that she was a lesbian. And maybe a lot of people who are Willa Cather fans, like, don't even know that, but she, like, lived with a woman and... all this stuff, but like when she died, apparently that woman like burned all her journals and notes that they had to each other because they knew that their relationship could get out that way once she was dead, that people would want to go back through her old stuff and like publish things like that, as you know, that's what happens when authors who are famous die. And so to keep it from getting out that they were in a relationship and that Willa Cather was a lesbian, like, she burned all that stuff. And so it's only kind of through piecing it together later that people have been able to even know that fact about her. And that's kind of a, I mean, this movie is obviously similar.
There's a similar thing going on with some of the famous writers for the Harlem Renaissance as well. Like, Langston Hughes is pretty famously gay. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. It's almost never talked about.
Yeah.
And there's a similar scene in the movie where that reminds me of the, talking about Willa Cather's partner, where she finally finds the watermelon woman, Faye Richards, like, lifetime partner. And she just wants to put a certain spin on her life that mm-hmm. Cheryl doesn't agree with. And she's like, well, it's my history, too, you know? And that was really interesting.
She's like, I'm really excited to, in her note, she's like, I'm really excited to tell you all these things. It's like, but mm-hmm. don't talk about this thing. And it's kind of like, a lot of the movie is about how sort of almost everyone wants to, like, make history a certain way for themselves, regardless of what the facts are, and, like, how this erasure can come from all sort of different elements, like, you know, Tamara doesn't want to watch the old films because they're racist, and it's like, mm-hmm. that's understandable, but at the same time, it, like, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of, I don't know how to put it, it's like, it's still part of the history, like, you can't, like, just ignore a negative part of the history, and then it just goes away or something.
The schools that were trying, I don't know, I mean... like take the N-word out of Tom, not Tom Sawyer, but Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I'm like, well, I mean, it's a really, slippery slope, yeah, obviously.
Disney,
but
yeah, Disney, like, discontinuing Song of the South or whatever. It's like, yeah, it's still part of your history, no matter how much you try and keep people from seeing it. I remember a friend of mine actually got really excited when she found a copy of that, that somebody had, that they had her make a copy of it. She worked at a video store, and she was a black woman, and she was really excited. And I was like, why would you be excited to find that? Like, isn't that supposed to be, like, really racist? And she was like, nah, I don't think it's racist. Like, it's part of history or whatever. And I was just like, okay. But I didn't understand that dynamic at the time, but now I'm kind of like, okay, I can see that. Like,
it's still racist, though.
It's still racist, yeah. But it is, like, it's like Ruben said, like, you know, you can't just erase the bad parts of history. Like, they're still there.
Yeah, I mean, there are important things to take out of racism. You can't just be like, oh, well, we don't cast women as mammies anymore, so don't ever watch or think about those films.
Yeah.
Right.
And, of course, we do still cast black women as mammies, so.
That's true.
It's not so blatantly.
I also thought it was a subtle joke in the scene where she's berating the sister of the director about, you know, at least she's like, your sister was a lesbian or whatever, and then, like, this obviously, like, housekeeper lady comes in behind her and is like, what's going on in here? And I was like, oh my god.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good one.
I liked all the photographs a lot. They were my favorite part.
Yeah, I was really surprised to find out that it was all, like, just constructed, because I thought the photographs were really good and they looked like they legitimately could have been from,
it totally looked real. Yeah,
from the you know, the Depression era.
I assumed that they were, like, real photographs from some person's life. The actress who played the Watermelon Woman. But, I mean, Basil said, you know, I guess he found it at the end that it's fake, but I felt pretty early on when she was, like, showing the clip for the movie, Plantation, whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, this can't be a real movie.
I
was like, it doesn't look like it's from the right time period, for one thing.
Yeah. The movie clips I could 100% tell were not real. I was like, yeah, there's no way those movies are real, because they're definitely shot on video. And they're definitely not from the 40s. Like,
I don't think they were shot on video.
I think they were.
I'm pretty sure they were either shot on video or transferred to video.
Yeah, they look like it. Like, you can tell they're not shot on film.
The whole movie shot on video? Because some of it, like, really was, and so I assumed that the rest was shot on film, because the part when it cuts to Tamara's point of view when she has the video camera, I'm like, oh, this looks like garbage, so maybe the rest of the movie is shot on film because it doesn't look nearly that bad. But
yeah, it's definitely not like a, I don't know, like,
I think it's shot on multiple video cameras of differing quality. But I don't think any of it was shot on film.
Yeah, I was going to say, because if it is film, it's not, like, studio-grade film. Like, it's, because studio-grade film, you can always tell, it's, like, studios
it's
have
not
their
film.
Own. Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, you could tell it's not that grade. It's like, a lower grade or something like that. But, yeah, I'm pretty sure that it was video.
I didn't know video could look that good. And not that it looks great, but, you know, it's still, like, 1996. That's, like, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess maybe it was, like, video as opposed to digital video. Because I know digital video looked like garbage for a pretty long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, maybe they shot it on, like, beta or something.
Mm-hmm. There's enough contrast, though, that you could tell, you know, different who was shooting, or, you know, what was the movie and what was the movie within the movie.
Yeah.
Which was nice, that blurring there. And I love that opening scene where they're paid to film the wedding and they just film people looking uncomfortable.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That scene was good. I forgot about that. And they're like telling the photographers to get out of the way. They're like, hey, could you move our video?
Right. Right. Who totally just ignored them.
And then they added like some real life poverty into that wedding video. That's what people want in their wedding video.
The urban realism. And Tamara complaining the whole time.
I wish I had that kind of chutzpah to just like insert my own auteur vision into like just quick work for hire jobs. Be like, it's still my movie, it's still got my name on it, so
can you imagine like David Fincher as like a wedding videographer? He's like, all right, we're gonna need you to do the part where you say I do 75 times until we get it right.
For David Lynch.
Oh man.
Is he a perfectionist as well?
No, just whatever spin he would like the surreal. We're going to have a cow fetus instead of wedding cake. It's going to be great. You could totally tell the plantation memories scene was not 40s either, because there were no close-ups of the white actress, only the black actress, Faye Richards.
Yeah.
Which is why it was so compelling for her.
That's because the director was in love with that actress.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you show a close-up of some random lady?
Right.
To show your crush.
And I think there's an interesting sort of reversal where, in a way, what is the director's name again? The old woman director?
Martha Page.
Oh yeah, Martha Page. Where in a way, Cheryl is almost taking on her role, because Diana, even though they're not, you know, I mean, Cheryl's like the real director of this movie, and she's in it, but like, so then she's sort of shooting Diana with this sort of like, especially during the sex scene, obviously, but even when they're like flirting, it's sort of I don't know, interesting, so I guess like switcheroo of her taking on the role as the director but as a black woman, and then the white woman becomes the sort of like subject to be looked at.
I didn't know people sold produce out of the back of a truck. There's no grocery stores in this neighborhood.
They definitely do that in Mexico. Maybe they used to do it in New York.
This takes place in Philly.
Philly,
that's right. They go to New York for
Clit,
which is a real place, I heard.
Clit.
Yep.
Oh, cool.
And from my professor who used to teach in New York, she said that's a pretty close depiction of what Clit actually is like. That it really is like super disorganized and super.
We'll be organized soon, 30 years later. Maybe they should hire people who don't dump boxes of photos on tables.
Yeah.
That might help with their organization system.
Yeah. I think they're volunteers, though.
Yeah.
But she repeated that. It's volunteers.
I don't really have anything else to say about this movie. Do other people?
Nope. I think I've exhausted. I mean, I didn't take very many notes on this movie. I don't know.
I took a little less than a page, but I don't know. They're not very good notes.
I
really liked the performance of the guy who owns the video store. I thought he was really funny, especially when he keeps like asking if they learned the Bob system.
Oh yeah.
Are you learning the Bob system? It's like double funny because Bob system sounds like it could be like a corporate acronym that lots of things would like at Target. Yeah, our cashiers, the registers work on the Bob system. We'll teach you it. But then it's just like his name. So he's like, this is my system, the Bob system.
I also thought it was, I thought it was funny when Annie, he like asks Annie, he's like, have you learned the Bob system? She's like, I've been working here for 6 months or something like that.
It was funny, but so sad too. And they were doing real work, you know, trying to recover history. And he was upset with them for not catering to the, it was too close to real life.
Yeah.
Also, if we did a reverse Bechdel test, this film wouldn't pass. Like, none of the male characters ever talked. Yeah, which is great.
That doesn't happen too often.
It doesn't happen. I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, did two men even talk to each other in this movie?
No, I don't think so.
I think
maybe on the street interview.
I was going to say, don't the gay guys that they interview, they have a back and forth that's pretty funny, actually.
Yeah.
I thought they were pretty funny.
But aren't they talking about a woman, so it still doesn't pass?
Yep.
Yeah. I like them a lot, and like how, I don't know, everything having to do with homosexuality in this movie just like existed. Like nothing was like ever, there wasn't like an introduction before something came. It was like, those guys appeared on screen, and it's like, oh, it's three gay black guys. It was just like, this just
I liked
exists.
Her euphemism, in the family. It was really great.
Yeah, I liked that. I mean, and the way that she didn't feel the need to like make the characters, I don't know, super, we talked about this a little bit, but like paragons of the community, that they're like, it feels like a movie that's very much, even though it's accessible to everybody, it feels very much like made for, you know, black lesbian women, like, as opposed to, you know, trying to cater, like, show off, this is the black lesbian experience, white people, it's not scary or dangerous. Like.
And also that question of identity, when she describes an ex as, like, I wrote it down, Afro-heavy, femme-centric. Like, yeah, and all these, like, different modes of being a black lesbian and what that meant, like, subtly hinted at.
Yeah, I like the euphemism for it, too, when she said, so she was a little spiritual.
Right, yeah.
A little spiritual.
I think Dr. Jameson would say that character, even though we don't meet her, was still in the sea of blackness when you're really trying to regain your African roots and wearing dashikis all the time and refusing to talk to white people and stuff like that. I assume that's what she meant.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie reminded me that I think people singing karaoke badly will always be a funny joke to me. No matter how many times I see it, I always laugh.
Oh, man. What was the first song that woman... There was some woman up there singing another song. Like, it was like, I like...
Oh,
I like
the one Tamara was trying to set her up with?
No. There's just like a random woman.
When they intro the scene,
yeah.
I think it's
Boogie. It's
karaoke.
It's Boogie Oogie Oogie, I think is what it is. I said boogie, oogie, oogie till you just can't boogie no more. I really like that rendition. Good times. I have nothing else to say about the movie.
Yeah.
Claire? Oh. Is she frozen?
Nope.
I guess so.
Frozen in a smile.
Let's just wait silently to see if she has anything else to say.
It's the big...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, my microphone.
Patrick did not edit this part.
Nope, I think I'm good.
Nice.
Sorry about that.
No, it's all good.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked the film.
Yeah. Oh, did you want to say why you chose it, or?
I've seen it on a lot of people's syllabi, and so it seems kind of canonical. Yeah. One of my favorite professors at UO does queer historiography, and he puts this on his syllabus for undergrads. And so I wanted to see it.
Yeah, I tried to tell my professor that she should show it in her film history class this coming term, because she was asking. She's like, would anything? And I was like, you should totally show Watermelon Woman, because it's like contemporary film history, so like 1970s to the present, and I feel like as like an alternate canon movie, this is pretty cool and pretty important, I guess, and overlooked.
No, they should just show Spielberg and Scorsese. That's it. It's the only thing that's
like The Color Purple instead.
For the last 40 years.
One of the essays I One of the essays that I read was about how bad that movie is compared to the book,
no,
like the way that Spielberg changes it to.
Is everybody still there? I got a server. Oh no! Oh no! Hello. It's so lonely here. Oh no. No. Hey, you're back.
Oh, where's Claire?
I don't know.
Did everyone get dumped?
It dropped everybody.
Okay.
I'm really looking forward to putting together the audio from this part.
Did everyone get booted?
I think so, yeah.
I think so. I thought I just got frozen, and then I restarted, and everyone was gone.
This is just going to be all of us talking over each other, like, oh, no, what happened?
Oh, I'm always silent when that stuff happens.
Oh.
I started to continue my point, and then I was like, oh, wait, probably everyone's going to be talking, so I should probably not do that.
Good times.
Well,
should we invite Claire back real quick, or
I did, but I'm gonna go ahead and start wrapping up. I hope she can be here for the bye.
Yeah,
I did send her an invitation again. There she is. Okay.
Hey,
just
sorry.
To thank everyone again for listening to the podcast. We appreciate it. Please subscribe on whatever podcast subscribing system you use. To catch all our episodes, and give us a nice rating and review. And once again, thanks to Claire for picking this movie and for joining us this week. Hope to have you back again soon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It was fun.
We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.